This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Durham and baseball are intimately connected in the minds of many Americans because of the movie Bull Durham.
You guys, you lollygag the ball around the infield. You lollygag your way down to first. You lollygag in and out of the dugout. Did you know what that makes you, Larry?
Lollygaggers.
Lollygaggers. What's our record, Larry?
8-16.
8-16. How'd we ever win 8?
It's a miracle.
It's a miracle. This is a simple game. You throw the ball. You hit the ball. You catch the ball. You got it!
But the relationship between the city of Durham and sports dates back to, and that sport in particular, dates back more than a century before the film. In the late 1800s, Durham's American Tobacco Company played an important role in the creation of the baseball card. Tobacco companies were the first industry to use baseball cards in their advertisements, and the most famous baseball card of all time advertised the American Tobacco brand. A two-part exhibit examining tobacco's role in the history of the baseball card is currently on view at both the Museum of Durham History and the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. And I'm joined in the studio today by the exhibit's curator, Adam Berenbach. Adam is a baseball junkie and an archivist at the Center for Legislative Archives at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Adam, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
So the origin story of the baseball card is really interesting, and what's fascinating to me, and I just learned this getting ready for the show, is that it goes hand in hand, the history of the baseball card, with the history of the tobacco industry.
Right. The tobacco industry really was centered around plug tobacco and cigars for most of the 19th century, and as the 1880s came about, the cigarette grew in popularity, and there was sort of a growing need for the ability to make cigarettes faster in order to sell them faster. There's a competition. I think it was Allen and Ginter in New York sponsored a competition to build a cigarette rolling machine. And a guy named James Bonstock developed one. Nobody wanted it, but James Buck Duke saw the value of it and began using it and immediately changed the cigarette industry. Competition that came out of that created what was called sort of the cigarette wars in the mid-1880s.
Once everybody catches up to the technology, now you've really got a problem. You got to make your brand stand out over the others.
Exactly.
Right? So what's that got to do with baseball cards?
Well, once the competition became so heated, advertising budgets just grew. And Duke, while being, smart enough to grab onto the technology, but also knew how to develop the technology of advertising. And he and a team of people were at the forefront and very creative in developing different ways to advertise these things. And one of them was to take advantage of the current craze in card collecting, both with CDVs, carte de vis, and trade cards. And so they developed, along with other companies, but Duke seemed to do it best, these insert cards, which would be put into the small packs of 10 cigarettes and could be collected and traded. And they had all sorts of images, actors, actresses. Duke actually preferred the actresses, which was a point of contention between him and his father, who had founded the company. But baseball players were also there. And, of course, those are the types of cards that lasted the longest.
Now, is this the birth of the celebrity endorsement, or had this been going on for some time?
There was a gentleman who worked for Duke, I think his last name was Small, who had I'm not sure if he was the first, but he was the first to do it successfully to approach some of the actresses and arrange for specific endorsement and specific, if you will, contracts to work with them to make sure that their image was only going to be advertising their one particular brand. And then, of course, once this competition grew to a head, Duke had found a way to essentially buy out the competition and formed the American Tobacco Trust in 1890. And after that, once they were all combined, the need for advertising budgets with a lack of competition dwindled.
Right. So the Antitrust Act would take care of that. So he's going to have to get back in the industry. This is fascinating. You've got an industry that now becomes one of the wealthiest in the world. I think it's around 1890. The Duke Tobacco Company or American Tobacco is the largest exporter in the world of any product at all.
Mm-hmm.
1890, Durham, North Carolina. And so lots of money. At a certain point, again, a need to distinguish yourself from your competitors. So you put money into advertising. We have celebrity endorsements at this time. What about the card, the trading card? Tell us about the history of that and where that fits into this historically. What accounts for the rise in interest in the card?
Well, I think it was this 19th century fad of collecting all types of this type of ephemera, these types of cards. And like I mentioned, the CDV craze that really started in England.
A CDV is not a DVD, obviously.
Right. the carte de vis, which were, I could be wrong on this, but silver gelatin or albumin prints mounted on cards.
Mm-hmm.
And in England, they started with members of the royal family and other famous folks. And families would put together albums and collect these as families. And that craze jumped across the pond, if you will,
mm-hmm.
And became popular in the United States with all sorts of these small, I hate to call it, small distribution or not a whole lot of cards
right.
made by various individual and local photographers and groups, and people would collect them. And so when the tobacco company started to insert these items into tobacco products, that carried along the trend. And not to get too far ahead, but as the century turned and we get into the 20s and 30s, baseball cards fell by the wayside, but this trend of collecting these insert cards continued and grew to the point where in the 20s and 30s it was all over the world. People would collect these cards, and I'm sure you've seen in bars and restaurants the tobacco cards on walls
right.
with all the birds and natural sights.
And, of course, postcards and other sorts of ephemera like this
right.
are making their way around, again, kind of collectibles and postables. What about the technology? It changes now. When do we go to lithographs? Because these become, in a way, lovely little artifacts. Right?
There is a direct connection between the development of or at least in time between the development of the lithographic art and this boom in tobacco products and the need for advertising. And the lithographs that were used, most of the early cards tended to be more like the CDVs, which were pasted prints onto cardboard. Mm-hmm. And those types of cards still survive to this day. Mm-hmm. The Old Judge cards, which are a famous set of Old Judge tobacco, but they are in terrible condition, and they're peeling and falling apart. But some of the early sets from the 1880s started to use this lithograph technology. And there's a particular company called the American Lithograph Corporation or the American Lithograph Trust, which Duke eventually became partners with in the 1890s during this lull. And they would play a big part in producing the wonderful lithographs that you see in the sets from 1909.
All right, so then we'll move it forward a little bit. When the Duke family builds the American Tobacco Trust, they own the business. They've got a monopoly. That gets broken up. So what happens to the advertising industry and the baseball card?
In around 1900, 1901, Duke expanded to worldwide trust and became part of the British Tobacco Trust. At this point, the Sherman Antitrust Act is passed, and the Justice Department begins to look into a variety of these trusts like Standard Oil and especially the Tobacco Trust, now that British Tobacco and American Tobacco are one large worldwide item. So this is about 1907 that the process begins with lawsuits and eventually moving up to the Supreme Court. And so the American Tobacco Company, after having about 20 years of not having produced much in the way of mass marketing decides to produce this set of nearly 500 cards of baseball players. There are a few other subjects, but baseball players were the key element here, advertising a variety of different brands, Sweet Caporal, trying to think of Polar Bear.
Polar Bear, which is something like the best scrap tobacco. What do we have going on there?
Well, I was just reading something actually recently about the fact that it's an oxymoron, the best scrap tobacco, because scrap tobacco is supposed to be the worst tobacco that you can get, which is why it's cheap and you can get it. So, that's another wonderful bit of advertising history where you can say that it is the best of the worst.
The best dregs you've ever drunk.
Exactly.
Well, that's kind of neat. So, okay, so now they're back in the business. They've got to compete. They're doing that. But then there's a drop-off in I want to ask you one more question first, because tell us about the pictures. Does this mean also there's a rise in the interest in baseball? Obviously, they've chosen baseball, so there must be a rise in that. So tell us about that, and then who would be featured on these cards?
So you have this beautiful confluence in 1908, 1909, 1910, where baseball is just saturating the country. There is, this baseball boom. It's been a popular thing for quite some time, but this is at the height of its popularity. It's everywhere you go. And so it makes sense that American Tobacco would try to take advantage of that. There were a series of photographers who, I want to say Conlon was one, but I could be wrong, who contributed images that were then set to the lithographs and printed and distributed from all different types of players. There is evidence that sports writers and other individuals associated with American Tobacco and some of those entities would go out and contact ballplayers and, if not draw up contracts, at least make some sort of formal agreement. We'll give you a few boxes of this or that if you would, allow us to use your image. And if you don't, well, we're going to use it anyways. and so the story goes, at least, that Honus Wagner, who was the premier shortstop for the Pittsburgh Pirates, a Hall of Fame player, and at that point at the height of his popularity and athletic talent, he decided to not have his image used. Now, originally, the story was that he did not want his image used to sell tobacco to children. But it's turned up a few other tobacco items that he didn't care about that were, under his radar or not. So
maybe he was holding them up for a couple extra bucks.
That's the current theory, but there's not really been any proof either way.
But in any event, his picture's already out there, and then he says no more.
Right. And so a few players did this, but where there had been a few printed, they noticed that it was happening and contacted and said no dice. But Wagner, of course, being the most popular player and the most desirable card, you have this perfect intersection of supply and demand. And so his car goes unfound by many of the kids and anybody else collecting. One of those people was a guy named Jefferson Burdick, who he was an electrician. He's arthritic and I guess you could describe him as a shut-in, but he became this prolific collector of not just the baseball, but all of the tobacco inserts, and eventually produced a catalog that was called the American Tobacco.
He's got 303,000 of these things, right?
And he cataloged cards each of every kind. And every single one of them.
Because they ended up giving him a chair at the museum, right? Because he didn't like the way they were doing it, and he was so much in the way. They said, all right, here, you sit here. And 15 years later, he finishes the catalog.
He walked out the door, just stood up and said, I'm done, walked out, and I think he was dead a week later. I mean, it was just his life's work and his life's passion, and once it was done, it was done.
So Honus Wagner, a guy I've never heard of, if you would ask me whose card has fetched the most money in all of card fandom, I would have named famous people who I know. Honus Wagner would not have come to mind.
Well, it's very much like, say, the upside down airplane stamp. The card itself is valuable because it's rare and because it's a great player, but the mystique around the card just adds to that value more and more. And there's a great story that in the 1980s, there's probably maybe 50 or 60 known copies of the Honus Wagner T206. But in the 1980s, a version surfaced that was almost in perfect condition. So it was a have-to-have by almost every collector. And eventually it was purchased by a team of investors led by Bruce McNall, who owned the Los Angeles Kings, and Wayne Gretzky. And, of course, famous people buying a famous card for what was then a record price of $450,000 drew a lot of news to an industry that was already growing, because of the nostalgia craze. And people, Wall Street Journal was publishing articles like, oh, penny stocks, no, invest in baseball cards. And so they sell the card and it gets sold to others and the price increases. It goes up to $1 million. And then eventually it comes out that the person who had introduced the card to the market had fraudulently trimmed the card to make it appear in a better condition than it was, which is a no-no in for any card and will diminish the value of anything once it's discovered, except for the Honus Wagner. Because this card already had such fame to it, the price only increased. And so I believe the last time it sold at auction was over $2 million.
Wow. And rising.
And rising.
So this is Honus Wagner. We've got a $2 million baseball card out there. And again, all this goes back to the tobacco industry. I suppose we should make note of the fact that in the early part of the 20th century, there was a protest and, you know, people began to get up in arms about tobacco products being promoted by athletes, baseball players in particular. And this eventually gives rise to bubble gum in baseball cards, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, at the height of the progressive movement. So you've got, you know, groups that are, you know, advocating for all sorts of, you know, not just prohibition and voting rights for women, but just, you know, it's the height of the progressive movement. And so, of course, there's these groups that are looking into protect children and the rights of children, not just in terms of work conditions, but all these other things. And, of course, it comes up that tobacco being advertised to children through baseball cards seems to a lot of people to not be very right. And so the concerns that were addressed to the tobacco industry occurred at just the right time, that as these companies were finding their own, you know, footing, right, and also you have the paper shortages that come with World War One, spending a lot of money on these types of advertising, it's just not worth it anymore. After the war, you have these same avenues of distribution, but in 1928, a guy named Frank Fleer, was it, who developed the bubble gum?
Bubble gum, right.
And bubble gum, of course, became a huge thing, and that's right in conjunction with the Great Depression. And so bubble gum, through the same sort of distribution channels as tobacco, seems to everyone a perfect way to advertise using baseball cards, and that's where it sort of changed over from tobacco as being the primary distributor to bubblegum.
But the co-branding was always part of this, and so that's why Topps gets into it, because they're essentially a bubblegum producer, and they decide, well, let's sell, put a few baseball cards in there as well.
Right, and it's interesting to note that Topps actually started its life as a tobacco company, and at some point in, I think around World War One, developed into a more candy-based company, and then when gum became the craze, they jumped on board the gum boat, and after World War II, they became synonymous with baseball.
And certainly the aesthetics changed, because by the time I was buying baseball cards, there were no advertising at all on the back. You would open the pack, you'd look at the cards, and on the back were statistics, and then you'd put that gum in your mouth and feel it shatter between your teeth.
And I think they kept the gum in the cards up until about the mid-1990s, and it always made your teeth shatter.
Sure, because it was put there in the 1930s when it began. So tell us about this exhibit now. What are we going to see? There are two exhibits, one at the stadium in Durham and one at the History Hub. Tell us about what we see.
Right. Over at the History Hub, it's just some information, images, and some digital content related to sort of the first part of the story, sort of the rise of the baseball card and American Tobacco's interest in it as it ties into Durham up until you have the breakup of the
Tobacco
Trust.
Yeah.
And then over at the baseball stadium, Angel Thorpe, who worked on this with me and developed a lot of educational content and really delved into sort of this later history. She developed a lot of content that's on the walls over on the second, I think it's the second floor of the stadium there, with a great amount of history about sort of what happens in this process of developing from a tobacco item to a gum item and how it intertwines with American history and American culture.
Fascinating stuff, Adam. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. It was great.
Adam Berenbach is the curator of the exhibit Durham and the Rise of the Baseball Card. He is also an archivist at the National Archives. The two-part exhibit is on view through September 5th at the Museum of Durham History and the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. The museum is also hosting a special event tomorrow afternoon at 2. You can make your own baseball card, and you can hear baseball storytelling from Adam Berenbach and find out more details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Gigi Dover and the Big Love. Stay tuned.